Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland.
Hi, welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. I have Noah Ernst in the studio, and I'm so happy to talk to you. Noah, you came in and we just started jabbing off air, and you made the point that we should just turn on the microphone. So that's what we've done.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about your Oregonian endorsement.
Well, I'm incredibly excited about the Oregonian endorsement. I think that it shows how far the campaign has come and my campaign has come. And, you know, I don't think I would have predicted it when I started running. And I certainly don't think other candidates in this race would have predicted that I would get an Oregonian endorsement. So, no, I think it's huge.
But why is that? Why are you the dark horse in this race?
Well, because I don't come from the background that a lot of candidates seem to come from, which is advocacy or the non-for-profits or having
a government
background. And I come from, you know, business. I come from the practicing law. I come from a different place. And so when I started the race, nobody had heard of me. I had no, you know, name recognition. I had no nothing. And so I really, my campaign manager, Darren, and I really just had to put in the work to start to build, you know, momentum and start to build ground support and all those sorts of things. And I think that, you know, that's a slow process where it ramps up very, very slowly. But once it starts to go, you know, it goes up a lot more quickly. And I think it really surprised a whole lot of people. And the Oregon endorsement, I think, is really, you know, I think just really shows how far we come because people are listening. People are hearing the message. People are saying, hey, this really, we think this represents the voter of East Portland.
You're in District 1.
Uh-huh.
And who are your constituents? Do you have an idea of who your constituents are and what their concerns are?
Well, District 1, as we know, is the most diverse district in Portland. I mean, there's a lot of different ethnic communities that reside there and a lot of different, you know, economic backgrounds that exist in or live in District 1. But it's also, on average, is far more working class than the rest of Portland. I think the average income level is lower. And what you find is it tends to be, I think, a much more moderate voter. It's a voter who's much more interested in public safety than maybe the city at large. It's much more interested in solving the homeless crisis in terms of cleaning the streets and making the streets safe again and making parks safe again. And they seem to be really, really interested in getting results and seeing things actually change. And they have a huge amount of frustration with the last, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years of the city of Portland sort of headed in the wrong direction, not achieving the results that they want them to achieve and ignoring the whole district.
Yeah, they feel unaccounted for, unrepresented, you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you see that every time you go talk to people. And it's you see it when you look at the infrastructure that the East Portland has gotten the least amount of investment in. But you also see it in projects that the city engages in, especially street projects and things like that, where the residents affirmatively don't want what's going on. The city knows they don't. Every single survey they do shows they don't. And they do it anyway because nobody cares.
Like what?
Well, my favorite example is Division Street. And if you've driven up Division starting at about 109th, they've put in medians down the middle of Division Street that go on for 3 or 4 blocks at a time. Nobody wanted that. The drivers, the people who drive on Division didn't want it. The residents that live around Division didn't want it. The businesses on Division didn't want it, told the city it was going to hurt their businesses incredibly. And the city did it anyway.
What was their city stated reasoning for this?
Well, it's part of the Vision Zero project, is my understanding. And,
Which is car accidents, car deaths.
They're trying to reduce traffic fatalities. Yeah. The only problem is that it doesn't work. That since they started Vision Zero in Portland, traffic fatalities have actually doubled.
Doubled.
Vision Zero hasn't worked in any single city in the United States that's adopted it. It originally came out of Sweden. and was successful in Oslo, Norway. And it just, it baffles me that our leaders, not just in Portland, but around the country,
apparently
can't tell the difference between European cities and American cities. And there's a huge number of reasons why it doesn't work in America, not the least of which is our cities are designed entirely different. But regardless, if you look at what they did to division, right, it's just created chaos, right? People don't know where to go. They don't know how to, they want to make a left turn into a business. They don't know how. We were out there talking to businesses.
It is really hard.
We were out there talking to businesses 3 weeks ago, or not 3 weeks ago, a week ago. And in the 2 hours that we were on Division Street, we saw one bicycle and two accidents. You know, it's, it doesn't work. But I tell people, even if it worked, right, we're a representative government. And if the people don't want something, you shouldn't do it to them. Right. And so my example is, and I don't know if you're old enough to remember the 55 universal 55.
I love that you just said that.
I don't know. The universal 55 mile an hour speed limit. Right. The federal government said if you want highway dollars, that the states had to make the maximum speed 55 miles an hour. No question it saved lives. That actually worked. But the reason that we don't have that anymore, and the reason that you can go 65 on the freeway or 70 in Washington or whatever, is because the people didn't want it. And in a democracy, the people have a right to make those kinds of choices. And so when you have a city government doing things that the people of Portland affirmatively do not want, that's not what democracy is. And we have to listen to the people of East Portland and say, you have a right to tell us how you need the streets to work for you. You have the right to tell us what you need in East Portland. And we don't have the right as a city government to do things to you. We're supposed to be doing things for you.
My impression is that because of the income level in District 1, tell me if this is completely off base, that these are a lot of people who just don't have the time to park themselves at city council all day long and testify.
That's exactly.
They're working.
They're working. And
or they're raising grandkids or they're raising great grandkids.
All those different things. And the reality is that those are more likely to be working class people, right? So they're more likely to have 9-to-5 jobs that they can't take. Like you said, they can't take time off from work. But the other thing is that, of course, where is every single meeting? Every single meeting is in downtown at the City Hall.
At City Hall.
So these are the people furthest away, right? So, of course, it's not just taking an hour
45
off.
Minutes to get there.
It's going to take you 45 minutes to get there.
A ticket, probably, parking ticket.
You're not wrong about that. But, and so there's a whole bunch of reasons why they find it much more difficult to participate in the process. But in addition to that, if you have historically been ignored even when you participate, right? So when you go to your neighborhood association meetings and the city shows up and proposes a project and everybody says, we hate this, and they do it anyway, it doesn't take many of those kinds of experiences before you think to yourself, what is the point of participating? They are not listening.
Yeah.
And when I talk to people in East Portland, I hear that a lot. When I talk to businesses, I hear that a lot. You know, there's a real sense that they're shocked that I'm there. They're shocked that I'm running for city council. And they're shocked that I'm listening to them to hear what their problems are. Because for so long, they felt not beyond ignored, right? But affirmatively, you know, written off or discounted. Like, nobody cares. And, you know, that's wrong. And East Portland has been part of the city for 40 some years, right? We are just as much Portlanders as every other part of the city. We're entitled to the same respect as every other part of this city, and we're entitled to the same level of investment as every other part of the city. And thankfully, we're finally going to get representation that will hopefully bring those things to East Portland.
Yeah, that's one part of this charter reform that I think the majority of us really like, mm-hmm. is representation, geographical representation. Noah, what Why are your constituents so concerned about crime? I mean, I can hear somebody theoretically listening to this and thinking, I would like to identify with somebody who, I mean, I think the majority of Portlanders want more police, but this is what the polling shows anyway. But I can also hear somebody thinking theoretically, I don't know why people would want more police. Well, why do your constituents have a fair amount of concern about public safety?
Well, I think because crime rates statistically are higher in East Portland. And so people are going to be more concerned. I mean, at a very basic level, I think that a lot of people misunderstand and the different communities in East Portland and think that they ought to think a certain way. And so, you know, you think there's people who think, well, the African American community in East Portland must hate the police because look at the negative interactions that they've had. And the reality is that they don't. They want their neighborhoods to be safe. They want their children to be able to walk to school or use the park or anything else. And that's true of a lot of, I think every different group out in East Portland is they want what all of us want. They want a safe city. They want a clean city. They want a city where when you call 911, you're not put on hold and an officer shows up right away. And when, if you live in parts of the city where crime is, there is more crime, right? Then you're going to want that even more. And it's really easy to, if you live in a neighborhood where there's virtually no crime, to think to yourself, oh, well, we don't need the police. We don't need this. You know, when you live in a neighborhood where your stores get, the store down the street closes because it's getting robbed all the time or shoplifting is going on, or you hear gunshots, you recognize how important law enforcement is. And I think that what people want is law enforcement that they can rely on, that's fast, that acts appropriately, right? They want the highest level of the highest standards in the police officers that we have. But ultimately, you know, you want somebody to come when you have an emergency.
How did you end up at Radio Cab?
Well, it's a convoluted story.
I can't wait.
So I have done a bunch of different jobs in my life. One of my first jobs was pulling green chain at a lumber mill while I was during the summers while I was going to college.
What does that mean?
Well, if you've ever been to a lumber mill, the log goes in one side and boards come out the other side, right? And it's green chain because it's not, it becomes dry. It's green until it's dried, right? And so we would stack them up and then they would go to a dryer. If that makes any sense at all. So
the wood is green.
The wood is green as it's coming out of the lumber mill. So it's a green chain. Anyway, the log goes in. It's all cut up in all different size boards. There's optimizers that make sure you get the most square footage out of every single log that goes in. So what comes out on the green chain, which is a big long conveyor belt, is boards of all different sizes. And there's guys that stand there and sort them into giant loads, right, of boards of exactly the same size. So each board is the same size. And it's just manual labor. It's hard work. But I did that to pay for college. I went to college. I got degrees in fine art and philosophy.
Where did you go?
Central Washington University. So
Ellensburg.
Ellensburg.
Yeah.
So I tell people I went into fine art because I liked it, and I went into philosophy for the money. When I got out
of those philosophy factories and fine art factories.
That's exactly right.
For a blue collar, for somebody used to doing blue collar work, I don't know what was the thought process behind that. That's so interesting.
I just had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so I took stuff I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
So when I got out of college, my dad and I actually started a small wood products business in Tacoma. We moved it down to Eugene.
Wow.
And
is that what your dad did before?
My dad was in the plywood industry his whole adult life.
Where did you grow up?
All over Western Oregon, Western Washington.
I went to Auburn High School.
I went to Snohomish High School, okay. But I lived in probably six different small towns, and because mills would close and we would move to another mill.
Wow.
So anyway, in Eugene, I decided that there's no way I could continue working with my dad. We have a great relationship now, but just we're not compatible business partners. So I went to law school and graduated and passed the bar in 2000. And I practiced law for a year or two in Eugene and then moved to Portland and practiced here.
You were just, we overlapped.
Oh.
Yeah, because I'm 2002.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah. So,
But you would have been too cool. Like you would
I would not have been too cool.
Just a 1L. Like you guys were busy graduating and getting jobs.
Yeah, not paying attention
to anything. Did you like law school?
I enjoyed law school. Practicing law, not so much, but I like school, believe it or not. If I could retire and just go back to school and learn things, I think that would be awesome. I always enjoyed that part of it. Because it's just thinking, it's learning and thinking, and that's enjoyable.
It's fun.
Yeah. Tests, not so much, but you know. So I practiced law, moved up to Portland. The last firm I worked at, we represented contractors and developers. And so in 2008, of course, the bottom fell out of that market. Mm. And in 2009, because I did litigation, so we had litigation that carried on for about another year. And then I got let go into what the American Bar Association described as the worst legal market since the Great Depression. And so I was unemployed for about a year and a half. And a friend of mine said, hey, why don't you drive a cab until you get a real job? And started driving a cab, which it turns out is a real job. Drove for 3 years at night. Had a great time. I really enjoyed it.
Why at night?
Because that was what was available.
Yeah. Okay. You took it.
I took it. You got to work when you got to work.
Well,
right?
That's true.
But I really enjoyed it. It's a great job. It was a much better job, obviously, before Uber and Lyft, but it's a great job and made decent money. And then a superintendent position opened up there and I applied for that and I got that. And because I'm still an active member of the Bar Association, I now get to do sort of in-house counsel stuff for Radio Cab and try to boss around cab drivers. And
are you still driving too?
No, not driving anymore. So once I became a superintendent, I can't then also be a driver.
Oh, the separate.
It's a separate because the superintendent's a management position.
Yeah.
You know.
And the others are union? Is that part of
it? No, they're independent contractors. But at Radio Cab, it's a great company in that the company is owned by cab drivers. So not all of our cab drivers are owners, but all the owners of the company are cab drivers. And we run the company essentially to break even, to provide the services to cab drivers so that the cab drivers can make a good living.
Wow.
And it's just a good company. And yeah, it's a good job. And I've just been happier there than I was practicing law. So I've stayed there. And yeah,
that's great. That's a great story.
And it's just,
you know, I know a lot of unhappy lawyers and I bet you do too.
Yeah. There's a reason that I think the statistic is that something like half of lawyers leave the practice after 10 years. And what amazes me is that the gripes about the legal profession are things that are entirely within the control of lawyers, which is everybody hates the lack of collegiality and everybody hates the work-life balance. And both of those things are entirely within the control of attorneys.
Yeah.
So
I think the latter seems to be shifting just with COVID and a lot of people working from home and younger people coming up who are just uninterested in billing probably the hours that you did, certainly the hours that we both did really at that time.
Yeah.
And so I think they're just not going to do it. And then if enough people say no, and then collegiality, I don't know what to do about that. I really don't.
I think it's, you know,
you think it would be better here. It's really not.
It depends. Interestingly, my experience talking to people has been that the criminal lawyers have far more collegiality than the civil attorneys.
That's my sense too.
And the reason is because when I had a case with people, right, on the other side, that was probably the only case I would ever have against them. They had no incentive to
do you any favors,
to play nice.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a criminal attorney, the likelihood is not only are you going to have more cases with that district attorney or with that defense attorney, you may have 3 or 4 cases right now in addition with that same attorney. And so if you act like a horrible person, that's going to come back to you immediately. And so it gives everybody an incentive to be on their best behavior a little bit. And, you know, it's just a shame that people try to do things like that to get some small advantage, and I don't think it works, but it just makes everybody's life harder. So
why run for city council?
Well, that's a good question, because it never occurred to me that I would run for political office until very recently. But since Uber and Lyft came into Portland or were allowed into Portland, you know, I was part of the what was called the Transportation Fairness Alliance. I was the spokesperson for that. And we were trying in that process to get the city council to at least try to enact some rules that were going to be fair and create a level playing field. And we're totally ignored. And Uber and Lyft got everything they wanted when they came into Portland and decimated the taxi industry. But for the last, since then, and which is now about 8 years, I've been working with City Hall and, you know, city staff and the different advisory committees and, you know, talking to commissioners and trying to get code changes passed that would, you know, be simple fixes to the current state of the code. And in 8 years, we haven't been able to get a single code change put in front of city council and passed, even when PBOT has agreed with the code change.
What is that about?
It's about commissioners who didn't care. It's about PBOT staff that, you know, for hire transportation is a tiny part of what PBOT does. And so they don't, you know, when you try to pass it up the chain of command, nobody's that interested. It's about city attorneys who take, you know, 4 months to review something. But the more I did that, the more frustrated I got. The more I thought to myself, this is a terrible way to run a city. And we can't be the only ones who are experiencing this kind of dysfunction, right? And nobody seems to care. And it's just amazing to me. And so, you know, we had some real problems in that PBOT got put under Chloe Udaly, who didn't care at all about anything related to PBOT. And then it went from her to Joanne Hardesty, who affirmatively told PBOT and her other bureaus, don't bother me. Only thing I care about is homelessness. So don't call me, I'll call you. So for the years that she was in charge of PBOT, literally nothing got done. And it just got more and more frustrating. And then this new change in the format of city council happened. I started looking at it going, this is an opportunity for new voices, for people who are coming from a different background, for people who, you know, are just think that we can make the city of Portland a better place. And a friend of mine said at one point, jokingly, hey, if you should run, I can get you elected. And it was that sort of that spark that made me start thinking about, wow, maybe I could be someone who could run. And thought about it and decided to go for it. And here we are.
I'm so glad that you did.
Well, I Thank appreciate you. That.
I know your constituents are. I mean, I guess the proof is in the pudding, but I've heard nothing but amazing things about you. Too many emails to read from people in your district they've talked to you. You're canvassing.
I really appreciate that. I'm not trying to be anything other than what I am. I'm trying to go out, ask people what they think is important from City Hall, you know, tell people, you know, hopefully people will vote for me because my priorities are their priorities. But I tell people that the number one most important thing that I will do if I am on City Hall is to listen to the people of East Portland and to advocate for them. Right. I'm not running for me. I'm running for East Portland. I'm running for a rational voice on city council who's going to go out to East Portland. And when East Portland says, this is what we need to fight for that. And I tell people, I say, I have good ideas. Right. And if I have some great idea and I go out to the people of East Portland and I say to them, hey, this is my great idea that we should do. And they say, we think that's a terrible idea. Then I'm not going to do it. Right? Because I answer to them. They're the people that I want to be on city council to advocate for and to whose interests I want to protect, because it's just, they have been so ignored for so long. And we still, when I looked right before I got in, so I came in at, in, I think, February, I've officially decided to run. And I looked at some of the candidates who had already, it had announced, right? And I thought, these are the same type of people with the same sort of ideas that we have had in city government in Portland for the last 20 or 30 years. And so I thought, there is clearly space for me in this race. There's clearly space in this race for somebody who's going to come in and say, we have to be focused on results. We have to be pragmatic. We have to have accountability in City Hall for where all this money that we're spending is going. And
right. Like, why wouldn't you look at results for Vision Zero before you implement something like that? Like, why don't we do things like that?
My theory is that Vision Zero, people like because it prioritizes bikes and pedestrians over cars. And we in Portland have a large portion of the advocacy community that thinks you are a bad person for driving and thinks that cars themselves are inherently bad. And the reality is that even if you say building Portland and specifically and especially East Portland around the car was a bad idea, right? That's still what happened. We still live in that world where the best, most efficient way to get around East Portland, right, is by car. And so to say that...
I think it's actually still true about Portland generally, no matter how... I mean, they haven't made it functional, in my opinion.
And
nobody wants to ride a Max that has 90% fentanyl residue on it. Nobody wants to do that.
Nobody. But even if, right... it wasn't that way. Where is the North-South Max in Deep East Side? Where is the Max, where is the Max train that goes to the Deep East Side?
And it's too long.
And so...
you can drive faster. And if you have kids, if you're a single mom, if you're a grandparent, you're going to be stopping, you're going to be dropping off, you're going to have all their stuff with you.
But look at the... and then you look at, in East Portland especially, what has happened in the last 5 years, right? We've had two Walmarts close, which was... shopping for people, you know, we've had a Safeway close, we've had other stores close because of crime. And so now you've got people in East Portland who have to travel further than they ever had to travel to go to a supermarket, to go to a supermarket, to go shopping.
Basic things.
Right. And then you look at, okay, but what about schools? Well, the city hasn't put in sidewalks on a ton of streets. And so you're going to let your kid walk to school in the street? No. There's all kinds of things where they really have ignored East Portland. And then what they want to do is the big glamorous project on a major street where they can show that they're environmental, you know, whatever. And that's not what people want. If you talk to people, what they want is for you to put in sidewalks on the streets of their kids' school. They want you to fix the potholes. They want you to those sorts of things. And people think when I talk about, you know, how Vision Zero is a failure or, you know, that we shouldn't remove lanes of traffic on our major thoroughfares or things like that. They think I'm anti-bicycle or they think that I'm anti-pedestrian. And I'm absolutely not. But what I am is I don't believe the idea that we should punish people who have to drive for driving. And I refuse to believe the idea that the only way to build bicycle infrastructure is to build it on exactly the same main streets, right? We need to invest in bicycle infrastructure so that people who want to ride can ride safely and efficiently. We need to invest in public transportation so that it becomes a system that people can use in this city to get where they need to go in every part of the city. But the reality is, we have to drive, and we should, in addition to those things, be ensuring that when people have to drive, that that system is also an efficient system for them to use, and making it intentionally more difficult is just wrong.
Yeah, and it sounds like we're strangling business in the process.
Well, certainly along Division we are. And I went out there.
It's one of the busiest areas.
It's incredible, and it's sadly... I went out there, like I said, and we spent hours talking to different businesses along Division, and they told me that they've lost 30 to 40% of their business since that median went in. They will point out to you happily, point out the business next door that went under, the business that crossed the street that went under, the business up the road that went under. I mean, not happily in the sense of they're sad they went under, but, you know, they're just everywhere. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about or get asked about all the time in forums for candidates is How are you going to attract business to Portland, right? How are we going to grow our economy? How are we going to provide more jobs? And it's about how can we make Portland a place where businesses, especially small businesses, want to locate, where their employees want to locate, because small businesses is the driver of the economy. And then you look at things the city does that literally put small businesses under, and you're just baffled. Right. They refuse to listen to businesses about what they need to be, you know, successful in Portland. And I think that's just shocking, because those businesses employed people. They provided services to that neighborhood. Right. What's the point of a walkable neighborhood if you put every business that anybody would want to walk to under? It doesn't make any sense. And those business owners talk to me about how their property value has dropped by over 20%, right? In a city where property values are going up like crazy, because who would want to buy that business property with that median down the middle with 20, you know, knowing that 30 or 40% of the business that used to come there can't come there anymore? Nobody. So we really have to see and focus on how the things we do have ripple effects across the city, right? Transportation policy doesn't just affect transportation, right? And it, I think a lot of times that thinking outside of your particular focus doesn't happen. And so one of the reasons I'm running, and one of the reasons I think it's important to have people like me run, is because I don't come from a government background. I don't come from an advocacy background. I don't come from a nonprofit background that's focused on one particular thing, right? I come from the real world, right? I come from business. I come from practicing law. I come from working in, you know, what, manual labor jobs. I have that experience, and I recognize often those ripple effects, how some change that you make in city code can really have an impact that maybe you didn't think about if all you're thinking about is how good that program is to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes total sense.
And so I think that's that kind of life experience and that we need on city council. Somebody to say, oh, you want to change the street in this particular way. Okay, how is that going to affect the businesses on it? How is that going to affect the people who live near it? How is that going to affect all these different things beyond, you know, does it make it easier for somebody to cross the street? Because I think we can do both, but you can only do both if you're aware of the ways in which those questions need to be asked.
So Noah, what you said that you're running for city council to represent your constituents. Mm-hmm. What is your constituents' number one priority, do you think?
I think it's public safety. I don't think, especially for District 1, I think at this point, that is for most people sort of the number one thing on their minds. I think tied into that and a close second to that is homelessness, but I think there's a huge amount of overlap. I think people look at, especially in East Portland, where we have, you know, huge, encampments of those Winnebagos, or where we have, you know, a lot of that kind of different large scale encampments. Obviously people see a massive overlap between what's going on with that and public safety. But ultimately, I think public safety is the thing that makes everything else possible, right? The people talk about, well, we need to get people out to public spaces. People aren't going to come to public spaces unless they think they're safe, unless they feel safe. Oh, we need to get people onto public transportation. Like you mentioned, nobody's going to ride public transportation if they have to stop and air out a bus for 15 minutes because somebody smoked fentanyl on it.
They're not going to put their kid on it.
They're not going to put their kids on it.
And that's what PPS uses for buses, right? For high school kids.
Right. And so, you know, I think that underlies every single thing. You want a walkable neighborhood, people have to feel safe walking. And I think that's what one of the things the city of Portland has really lost. And East Portland, I think, has always had, like I say, a higher level of crime per capita, I think. And so they're much more aware of it. They're much more aware of the importance of public safety and wanting their streets and their neighborhoods to be safe and hearing gunshots at night and how scary that is. And so I really think that's the number one concern. I think people in District 1, and I think across Portland generally, I think are really running into what I would call compassion fatigue, right? They've been told for a long, long time that the response to homelessness or the response to drug addiction or the response to mental health issues on the street should be compassion. I think people...
Or that it's all housing.
Or that it's all housing. And I think that people are just very tired. And they want their city back. And they recognize that what we have been doing clearly has not worked. And
certainly not for them.
Not for them, but not for the homeless people either. I mean,
no,
it hasn't worked for,
not any, for anybody.
For anybody, but and so I think that they're much more, we have to stop deferring to the drug users or the mentally ill people or generally the homeless people and saying, you don't get to take over our sidewalks. You shouldn't get to take over our parks and public spaces. You shouldn't be able to do whatever you want, wherever you want, whenever you want with no consequence, right? And most people are compassionate, but they want to help people who want help, right? They want to help people who want to get clean, who want to get off the streets, who want to, you know, go get mental health services so that they can return to normal life.
What do you do with those people, though, and how do you work with the county, which is in charge of things like mental health and addiction?
Well,
the county just seems like an intractable issue right now.
The county has proven historically to be very, very difficult to work with from what I have seen, right? And that's frankly a tragedy because the more we can work together, the more effective we can be. I think the number one thing with the county that I think I would do is the same thing I would do with anybody that the city contracted or any program that the city had, right? What is the goal that we are trying to obtain? How is are the programs that we're funding going to get us towards that goal? And if they're not, then we need to change them. We need to do something different because accountability to results should be the most important thing.
Would you withdraw from the Joint Office of Homeless Services? If you were on city council, would you vote to do that?
I'm going to say at this moment, I wouldn't say definitively yes to that. And the reason is that one, frankly, I don't know enough specifics about what the city and the
negotiations.
Yeah, all those things.
That's fair.
So, you know, but would I be open to it? I think absolutely. I think there's not, my position is.
Well, we know our money's not being well spent. We know that. We have eyes and ears.
Right. Yeah. And what I would say is that I come into this from a place of pragmatism. No program, no allegiance is sacred. What we have to look at is it working?
I think it's not.
We do. I agree that what's going on with homeless is clearly not working. But what I mean is that if we can go to the county and have that discussion and say, how can we change what we're doing? How can we invest in programs that do work? How can we make commitments to reducing the number of homeless people on the streets so that we have objective and measurable goals? Then it makes more sense to work together than separately. Yeah. If we go to the city or the county and we say these are the things that we want to do. We want to have accountability to results and we want you to make commitments about the effectiveness of the programs you're funding and they tell us to go kick rocks, then clearly there's no point in giving them our money, right? Because we should be focused on those things. I think that's...
Yeah, I think without some kind of transformation there... I mean, the chair is the easiest, but we've got two more years of that. And then we could get a rational majority on Multnomah County in this election. This county election, in my opinion, is very important.
I agree.
Because in my opinion, right now, the only people who are saying, talking about solutions for the kinds of problems that your constituents are dealing with, that I think everybody in the city is dealing with, but that your constituents have been ignored particularly about, are Sharon Myron and Julia Brim Edwards. That's two.
Right.
That's it.
That's it. And
they're outvoted every time.
And that's, yeah, that's.
They're the only ones who seem interested in metrics, data, results, chasing money around, finding out where it's going, figuring out what's working, seeing if we can invest in it. It's just, there's no traction there.
No. And, but again, that's why I say we have to be open to anything. We have to be open to saying this isn't working. We're not going to do it anymore. But we also have to be open to saying if we can make this work, then let's continue forward. But, you know, and we'll see what happens. But
yeah,
again, maybe. People come to me in the course of this election cycle and they say, are you willing to pledge to support this program or pledge to support that program? And what I say is, I don't pledge to support any program, right? Because if your program works, if your program that you're trying to get me to pledge actually achieves the results that you say it does, and those are results that we as a city need, then I'll support it.
Yeah, there won't be any persuading to do.
There won't be any persuading to do.
The numbers will speak for themselves.
But when someone comes to me with a pledge as a candidate, what I tend to think is the reason you want me to pledge now is because you are concerned that when I learn more about your program, I'll realize that it doesn't do those things and you want me on the record before I learn that. That's how I feel about it. And a wiser man than I, and I wish I could remember who it was, once said that the number one reason to reject a pledge is the fact that it was offered. And I think there's some truth to that. Is let's be objective. Let's look at results. And let's do programs that work and stop funding the ones that don't. And the reality is we know in Portland that we have, you know, some real budget issues and we're going to have to make some really hard decisions. And the possibility exists that we'll have to cut a program that does work because we only have the money to fund one and there's another program that works better, right? So there's no way I'm going to commit in advance to saying I will absolutely support this thing. And because there's just so much we don't know, and I want to be able to make the best choice in that moment when we have all the information, because that's what we should be doing as people on city council.
Well, I guess you're focused on the right things, because it seems to me the question is, what can you do anything about? If you can't do anything about the county, what can you do something about? City controls police.
Right.
City controls fire.
Right.
City does control Peabot. I mean, there are, right. you've talked about the things you can do something about.
Well, and I think that's always the focus. I think that what we can do things about the county, but it's not direct, right? We can exercise leverage over giving them money or not giving them money, or funding programs or not funding programs.
Or leading, or putting pressure on via press conferences.
Right. I mean, so there are things that you can do to hopefully get them to move where you think they ought to go. But you're right. We have to focus on those things that we have direct control over. And that may be like law enforcement and recognizing that you can't smoke fentanyl in the middle of a public space anymore. Right. And that's could be a law enforcement issue, because if we can't, we have to control what we can control. Right. And, I didn't say that very well, but you understand what I mean is that we have to look at the city of Portland has to make Portland the city that its residents want it to be. And so we have to figure out how we can do that with the tools that we have in the best, most efficient way.
Well, it seems like you can, I mean, for one thing, we're suffering because we don't have enough police.
Right.
I mean, so if police are within your direct control, focusing on staffing members seems like something that you could actually do.
And yeah, absolutely. And it's not
how to attract more people.
How to attract more people. We know it takes.
How to get them through DPSST.
Right. We know it takes a long.
It's an incredible amount of training.
Yeah. Period of time to get a new recruit trained up to where they're an on the street solo officer. But we can look at how do we make our police force one that attracts laterals from other police departments. Right. How can we make the police department one where maybe people don't want to retire and want to stay an extra couple of years to stay on longer? Because one of our issues right now is we have a lot of people in big blocks retiring.
We do.
How can we encourage them to stay on a little longer if that's something that they're able to do?
Do you think attracting police has anything to do with the culture or perceived culture? Maybe it's not even real. Maybe the majority doesn't.
I think we clearly alienated a lot of law enforcement in 2000, 2001, and
with the defunding,
that whole movement and the protests and all those sorts of things, and the perception,
the 180 nights of burning, yeah,
the perception that
lawlessness,
that the people of Portland didn't want or don't appreciate law enforcement. And I think that wasn't true of the majority of people in Portland then, but the people who did believe that were incredibly vocal and incredibly,
and they had time,
right?
They had the time that your constituents didn't have.
Right. But I think we are seeing that come around. I think that we're recognizing that the majority of people want, you know, a police force that's adequately staffed, that can respond appropriately and quickly, that, you know, where the hold times for 911 become.
Yeah. BOAC, something that's within your control.
Right.
And if you're on city council,
so
Bureau of Emergency Communications.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think it's important that we don't just, right now we have something like 88 positions that are funded in the police department, but that aren't yet filled, that they're in the process of recruiting for. But I think it's important that we fund officers, not just those 88, but up to what is at the very least average for comparable cities in the United States.
Yeah, per capita. Yeah.
And so
and dealing with what we're dealing with, dealing with fentanyl,
yeah.
I mean, this is a unique place.
And so the measure, as I understand it, for the number of police officers in the city is the number of officers per 10,000 of population, right? And the average for cities like Portland is between 16 and 20 officers per 10,000 of population, right? We're currently just above 12. So we need, just to get to the average, just to get close to best practices, significantly more officers than we have, right? And significantly more than 88. And the reality is that if you have too few officers, then they have to prioritize, right? They have to say it's more important that we go to a shooting than we go to than going to a shoplifting event. And so what happens is often those things that affect you on much more of a daily basis are the ones that can't get addressed, right?
Yeah.
You're very unlikely to be directly affected by a shooting. Right. That does. And it happens and people are very affected and it's tragic, but it's statistically not the highest likelihood. Right.
But yeah, more likely your car is going to get broken into.
Yeah, your catalytic converter is going to get stolen. Sure. But what's most likely is every store that you go into right now has half of everything locked.
That's
up.
That's true, too.
Right. And so that's a reminder.
Bars on the windows, plywood.
Right. And that's a reminder to you and to everybody who lives in Portland and everybody who comes and visits Portland.
If they're lucky, they have private security.
That this isn't a safe city. Yeah. Right. And it's those kinds of little so-called petty crimes that can really destroy the livability of a city.
And honestly, it makes you not want to go into that business. Yeah. I went into one the other day and half the stuff was locked up and I was like, screw it. We'll get it on Amazon. I'm right. Not going to do this. I'm not going to wait around for somebody to unlock a soccer ball.
Right. And that hurts small, but you know, you're absolutely right. And so that's why you need a higher number of officers so that you can address all those issues. You have the capacity to respond to smaller so-called petty crimes, because those things will make Portland a much more livable city again. If you think that the bus is safe because you see a police officer every once in a while checking people out or checking tickets, or there's someone at the bus stop, or you see your local beat cop, you know, go down the street.
Yeah.
It reinforces the sense that this is a safe place. And that's fundamentally what's important in people's minds, is that
people talk about community policing and it just crack. People right. who criticize the police say, I wish we could bring back community policing. And they do too.
Right.
We all do. We would like to bring it back.
Right. But we have,
don't have that luxury right now.
No. And it's about numbers. It's about.
That's exactly right. If we have more police, we could do it.
And nobody, you know,
it's just.
Yeah. And people.
There's not a lot of depth there.
Right. And everybody, I think, wants best practices, right? They want the best police that we can have, the police that respond appropriately, that respond quickly, that treat people with respect. And we can have all that And one of the things that makes that possible is police officers who have more time to respond.
More police.
Who aren't burned out, who aren't working bunches of overtime hours, who can come to your emergency and actually spend a little time to make sure it gets resolved instead of saying to you, here's a police report.
Yeah, I
have to go to the next thing.
Right.
And that makes all the difference because those interactions that individual people have with individual officers are what builds communities.
That's the other thing that's so puzzling to me, Noah, is this defunding movement. You know, what happened is it created this huge vacuum, as we've all witnessed, and now there's private security everywhere.
Everywhere.
And they're armed. Mm-hmm. And guess what there's no accountability for?
Right.
Private security.
Yeah, there's not as much, clearly not as much training, right?
Well, it's not certainly not uniform.
Right.
I mean, we don't know what the standards are, right. And there's nobody weighing in on these people who were hired to be in charge of us in any whatever limited capacity it is. It still exists because people need it.
People need it.
That's what's going to happen. We will be Brazil. Like we're halfway there with this kind of a thing.
But I think that that's why this is an exciting election. And that's why
it is exciting,
because this election could be the start of turning it around again.
You know, I think that was last election. And I think I do. I think last election, these last couple, or the start of turning it around. We've got Joanne Hardesty is out.
Right.
Renee Gonzalez is in. Mm-hmm. Udall's out.
Mm-hmm.
Maps is in.
Right.
We've got Schmidt is out.
Right.
Vasquez is in.
Right.
Julie Brim Edwards is at county.
Right.
Things like that. Capital gains tax was roundly defeated.
Right.
There is a movement afoot. I agree with
that.
But
I think that
It is exciting.
It is exciting. And the fact that we now have districts and we'll now get some real representation from different districts. And also, I mean, I know that there's a lot of concern around ranked choice voting and how that's going to work. And people going to understand it? And is it going to work?
There certainly is.
Right.
There is for me.
But if it works like it's intended.
I'm not putting a lot of energy around it because it's here. It is here. So.
But if it works like it's intended, it should give voices a representation that didn't have them previously. And that will make the city council, I think, far more reflective of Portland than it has been in the past, where because every election was citywide, right? Everybody knew that who you had to appeal to was the Southwest Hills and Inner Southeast. And we got a very specific type of candidate from and I think this, if it works properly, if it works the way it's intended, I think we could have a city council that's going to be much more rational in a lot of ways, fingers crossed, and willing to do the things that need to be done to make Portland, the city it used to be in terms of livability, in terms of safety, in terms of cleanliness, and hopefully take us into the future as a place where people want to live, where people can afford to live, where businesses want to be, and we can start being the driver of this state again.
When we were off air, you and I talked about how we would have, it sounds like you still do, use the term progressive to describe yourself. Like, you feel like you're a progressive
person. Yeah, absolutely.
Person.
I feel like I'm a progressive person. And in that, you know, I think that especially socially, people should live the lives that they want to live. Right. And
regardless, that word has been hijacked at all in Portland.
I think that it's in that in Portland and in a lot of places, it's, if you don't agree with every single item that we think is progressive, then not only are you not progressive, you're somehow right wing. And
like closing roads and adding bike lanes.
Right. Yeah. It's whatever it is. And there's
whatever it is.
There's a lot of different things. And I think the sad thing is that there's a lot of people who view themselves as progressive people who believe in maybe universal healthcare, or believe in, you know, gay rights, or believe in other issues that people consider progressive issues, but they're rational. They want outcomes. Yeah, I mean, they want results.
You just talked about issues that are universally pretty popular in the United States.
Right. But because they don't agree that we should force every car off the road, suddenly the progressive movement thinks they must be right-wing nut jobs. And, you know, I don't think it's fair as a way to categorize people. And two, I don't think it's useful, because the reality is most of us are far more similar than we are different. And most of us want the same things. And I tell people that when I drove a cab at night is when I had the highest regard for humanity as a whole, because what you find out when you pick up people randomly from all over our city and people who come from everywhere, because, you know, people, tourists come here and all this stuff, is you realize that more than 95% of people one-on-one chatting with you are very nice and very friendly. And you get the impression in our society today where we like to make, you know, these guys are the bad guys and we're the good guys.
It's very black and white.
Yeah, that 50% of the people must be evil. The reality is that 95% of people are more similar to you than they are different. They want the same things from government. They want clean, safe streets. They want their kids to have a good future. They want their kids to have a good education. You know, they want to help people who want help. They want to buy into the American dream and buy a house and buy a car and all those things. And they want to talk with you like a real person and, you know, are genuinely friendly. And when they ask how you're doing, they want to know. And I think by having those sorts of litmus tests of whether or not I can, you know, agree, be your friend, I think we miss out on all of that, and we miss out on the discussions that we should be able to have that will lead us to be able to work together to make Portland a better place, to make the state a better place, to make the country a better place. Because we're in a situation, you know, people ask me, well, why aren't you a registered Democrat if you consider yourself a progressive person? And I say, you know, I'm not necessarily a joiner, but beyond that, good ideas come from everywhere. You know, why should I join one side in order to reject every single thing that the other side says, right? If it's a good idea, it's a good idea, and we should support it. And if it's a bad idea, it's a bad idea, and we should reject it. It doesn't matter where it comes from, right? And I think that's what gets lost in these labeling discussions about who you are, because you don't, I don't know, hate the oil storage system, or you don't hate the whatever it is. And like, we have to solve our problems by working together. And you have to do that by being open to listening to people, trying to meet them where they are, recognizing that most people are good people who really want to make the world a better place. And we may have some disagreements about some ways of accomplishing those things, but those are things we can discuss if we're open to discussing them, you know?
Yeah. I think, there are very few people who talk like that. And so I really, especially right now in this presidential election year, I really appreciate it. Well, everything is so polarized.
Yeah. And I think that that's when I talk about what I bring as a candidate, and my experience, you know, at all the different jobs that I've had where I've really worked with all kinds of very different people, right? The people who work at law firms are very different, you know, culturally, right? In terms of background and all that, from people who work at lumber mills or people who are short order cooks where I've worked or whatever. But again, you see all the commonalities. But working at a cab company, I think has been an amazing experience, because I don't know of another industry that's as diverse as the cab industry, where we have cab drivers that are immigrants to this country who are working 6 days a week to support their families. And we have people whose families have been in Portland for generations. And
lawyers.
We've had lawyers. I'm not the only lawyer that's ever driven a cab.
Yeah.
You know, we just have a mix of everything. We had transgender people driving cabs at Radio Cab before it was something that anybody talked about or thought about, because it's just a job where nobody cares, right? What they care about is, can you show up? Can you do the job? And so it's one of the few professions that just has really been welcoming to anybody. And that's been, you know, so when I go to work every day, I have to be able to work with an incredibly diverse population of people. And if I can't do that, if I can't work with everybody, then I can't succeed as a superintendent. And if all of us can't work towards the same goal, then we can't succeed as a company, right? And, you know, that's the kinds of real world skills of interacting with people, of working with people who are different than me, who think differently than I do, that I'll bring to city council. You know, I don't come from a background where I work at a firm where everybody thinks exactly the same way because we're an advocacy group that cares about one particular issue, right? I have people who care about all different things, and we all have to work together. And I think that's incredibly important for somebody who's running for city council in Portland, who's running for the most diverse district in the city, who wants to represent people.
I'm really inspired by everything you have to say.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
What else, if anything, do you want people to know? What's your website? We'll link it in the show notes, but where do people go if they want to donate?
So my website is NoahErnst4Portland.com. So not super exciting, but easy to find. If you search for Noah Ernst Portland, there's not a lot of us. You'll find it right away. I'm NoahErnst4Portland on the social media. You know, I would love, obviously, if people wanted to donate and support the campaign. We're in our final weeks, so it's a real push, to, you know, towards the finish line, and we're going to try to finish real strong. We're going out and knocking on doors and saying hi to people. We're sending out mailers, so hopefully you'll see one of those in the mail at your address. I think it's important to say that you're electing three city council members from your district using the ranked choice voting, and so I want to make sure that I say, if you support me, you know, rank me first. But look at Terrence Hayes, who I think is a great candidate in District 1 also. I encourage people who support me to support him. I think he's really a rational voice for city council also, and I think he and I will work great together. We're very complementary in terms of our background and experience. So I definitely encourage that. Check him out. Because there's 12 people on city council, and, you know, I would love to be able to say, vote for me and I'll do everything you want. But in reality, I'll be 1/12. And so it's important to have a group of people on city council that are going to be able to work together, that are going to have some of the same goals and objectives, and that are going to have the same commitment to listening to the people of East Portland and doing what they want. And that's true of every district, right? If you're listening to this in any other district, look for people who are committed to coming out, being in the district, listening to you as a resident, and trying to make sure that you're represented and that they're not going to city council as a extension of their advocacy for some particular point of view, but they're going there to really represent you. Because if we do that and we get a city council that's got some real rational people who are committed to achieving goals and holding the city and the county and other people accountable for results, we're going to be able to get a lot done.
Noah Ernst for District 1 City Council. Thank you.
Thank you very much.